So the bean chair, I can't remember what were the issues at that time. They really disappeared. John Guy was still the dean, and so I had a lot to do with him. I liked him. He was not seeking to be liked, but you began to understand him after a while, that the terror was bluff, and it was there to sort of make sure that he got his way, and he had a loud way to do it. And underneath, he was a rather humorous man, and occasionally at a moment when he was being very serious and shouting and ranting and rave, he would break up into laughter. Occasionally he would amuse himself. And when I first came and was introduced to John Guy, they took me into his office, and we had a session just one-on-one. And he was reading my resume, and he said, "Colescott, I see that you were a first lieutenant in the Army." And okay, well, nothing much has changed. Just think of me as the colonel, and you're still a first lieutenant. And it's true that I always had that reaction with it. You know, I felt like saluting. And when I was chair, it was in the our office was right up the stairs, one floor above the dean's office. And so if something came up, rather than ring me up or anything, he'd come pounding up the stairs and fling himself into my office, shouting, "Colescott, Colescott, where are you?" And I'd be hiding behind the desk. But actually, we got on pretty well. At that period, I don't think there were big problems. I think the money was good. The purse strings had loosened up because of the enrollment pressure. And I think probably John Guy was pretty good at getting money. And so we were in a hiring mode and an opening new sections mode. So the few things that I remember about my 2 years was that that we made some interesting hires that I thought made the department stronger. I think we very much needed Steppet because the sculpture had been poor. Dietrich was really a bad sculptor, and he left a residue there, and I think there were some temporary people between Dietrich and Steppet. But Steppet was a very strong, and he was a very fine teacher. He was authoritarian, and he knew his stuff. And he was very good on the committees, too. He's sort of a fine, arrogant Austrian, and a cultured, he was a cultured person, which we also needed. So we were getting better as a group. We were getting more diversified and stronger, and the people we were getting were performers. Initially here, the state shows, which were important to us, the Wisconsin Painters and Sculptors Show, which was then usually at the Milwaukee Art Institute, and then there was a show at the Union, the Wisconsin Salon, which was really an important show for the region, all the people in the state, and there was quite a bit of money to be won, and so the department began to dominate these shows, whereas before the Milwaukee group of painters and sculptors had dominated the shows. So Madison began a takeover. Meeker was doing very well. I was doing well. And there were a number of people who came, stayed a few years, and then left, went on to better jobs usually, and who were strong performers. The thing I remember about being chair, the most interesting things were the near scandals that we had, which made the job pretty lively. and I found myself solving marital problems. There were a couple of interesting problems of artists and their models, which were resolved, and I played a certain part in, we would have in-office, closed-door conferences and discussions, and my talents as a psychiatrist came into play. But so these things all were smoothed over without it going any further than the department. And so that was interesting. Even though, you know, it was sort of out all over the department, these things were known, and they could have gone further very easily, but we managed to keep the lid on. But after 2 years, I'd had enough. And also, I was beginning to get the opportunities to go to Europe. I had in 56, 57, I believe, I had a Fulbright grant to go to London. And I had had research grants from the grad school. I'd had two research grants from the grad school, a summer and a semester, which I'd gone to Paris. I'd gone to Paris once on my own under the GI Bill. So I had this period where I disentangled myself from the department quite a bit with the grant opportunities to not to travel, but to go to either London or Paris and to study. The Fulbright grant was particularly excellent for me. I was reaching the limits of serigraphy, I felt. I wanted a material. I liked prints, I liked printmaking, but the silk screens have certain limits, and I felt I wanted something that I could get a greater density of effect. And Sessler had interested me in etching, and I did a couple of small etchings down in his shop, and he was a very good teacher. And so I did a couple of prints with him, and I applied for a Fulbright grant to London. I had heard that the Slade School was excellent, and I got it and spent a year in London. And it was a wonderful year. I couldn't have asked for a better person to work with than Anthony Gross, who was the instructor in etching at the Slade School. He was very mature person. We got along very well. We had kind of similar personalities. He was a fine artist, painter, and printmaker, and he showed me in a year everything that you can do with copper plates. He was really abreast. He was a friend of Hayter's, so he knew all of the color experiments that Hayter was doing in Paris. And I had a chance to visit in Paris, too. I had a chance to go over and visit Hayter's studio and to meet him. And he showed me the color work that they were doing there. I got a gallery in Paris. Now, I'm not sure whether it was on this trip. I think it wasn't on this trip. I think it was on my Guggenheim year in the 60s that I became associated with the Gallery des Peintres Gravures. And with Jacques Frappier, who ran the gallery and who became a very big figure in French, the sort of printmaking establishment. But that was later. At this point, I learned how to do etchings. I learned enough so that I could take where I was with serigraphy and to carry that into color etching, to transfer the color serigraphs into color etchings. And So that I came back after this year with the tools and the knowledge that I needed. So you really couldn't ask for more than that. Plus a wide acquaintanceship with the artists in London. The other foreigner at the Slade School had been this Portuguese, Bartolomeu dos Santos. And he and I became friendly. We were the two foreigners. We were there on grants who were working with Tony Gross. And there wasn't that much interest among the regular students in prints. They had to do a certain minimum print project. So they would come, the students would come dashing in, and they'd spend a half an hour and do a little something, and then they'd leave. Whereas Dos Santos and I, we would be there all day, 2 days a week, during Tony's classes. And so he gave us a very special attention. There was a workshop nearby run by a Swedish woman, Birgit Sjöld. And it was a place where the artists in London who were interested in prints, they would pay a little fee and they would get time there to work. And Birgit was a very sociable person, and she loved to give little dues, as she called them. And so Birgit's dues about once a month, you know, everybody'd come and drink Algerian wine and have a good time, you know, sitting on the press beds, and, you know, trying to get off with some of these beautiful Arabian women and so forth. It was a very exotic crew there. And David Hockney would come to these, and a lot of people who were in print. So it was a chance to meet a lot of people, and I worked at Birgit's. I did a little teaching myself. Tony found that at a place called the Working Man's College, not too far from the Slade, it was an old Fabian School. They had a huge press down in their basement, which no one was using. And so I got the use of the room and the press to work there, and I taught a class of adults upstairs in a room that had a small press once a week. So I taught for them just to get the use of the facilities. Nice deal. So I came back after that period. I was working in Madison. I think I did open a section of etching alongside of Sessler's. When I got back from my Fulbright year in London with the etching skills, Sessler approached me and asked me if I wanted to run an etching class in his studio. See, we just had the one print studio, and there was not another room available. But he would teach on Tuesdays and Thursdays, you know, all day, and a night class. So the room was available Monday, Wednesday, Friday. And so he wanted to know if I would like to teach etching, and then he would narrow his offerings, his beginning offerings, to lithography and woodcut, really pretty. And so, of course, I did, because by now I was very interested in etching. And so that worked quite well. We didn't get in one another's way because we were there on separate days. We shared the office. Then in 65, 66, I believe, I got a Guggenheim to go back to London. And at that time, I didn't work at the Slade, but I was over there quite a bit. I had two studios. Oh, I know. I had the studio in Angel Alley, which is on the east side of town. Angel Alley was the scene of one of Jack the Ripper's most famous killings. As a matter of fact, on the sidewalk, they have the outline of just where the body was. And every day, there would be tours that would come over to tour the Jack the Ripper tour. I'd found this old schoolhouse there that was not being used, and I think there was a printing firm on the ground floor, and the two top floors were in pretty bad shape, but unused, and so I was able to rent the top floor. And it was a wonderful studio, and I had that all during the Guggenheim year, and with the Guggenheim funds, I bought a big press over there, and really had awfully nice setup. The following year, because I was so close to Rome, it was cheaper to bring me to Rome than to bring someone from the States. I was invited to teach the next year at the Tyler School in Rome, and so I brought my press and moved to Rome. So the period then it expanded to a fairly long period in Europe, 2 years. And I got back at the end of that, and Sessler had died. And so I think it was at that time that Meeker and I primarily really sat down and began to plan what to do with the print area. And the building, the new building, was in the works, and so we had a chance to bring in Gleckler and Damer, and to plan to have a print area where each specialty, each medium would have a person who performed in that medium and would be in charge of the teaching of that. And so I think really our great period began at that. I mean, it would have been a greater period with Sessler, but that's the way it went.
That was about 1968 or so?
Yeah, it was in my notes. It's when I got back from Europe. And I was 66, 67. I was in Rome. And my note here is that Sessler dies during that period. I think it was. So that then the next teaching year was 66, 68, 67, 68. And at that point, as I remember it, that was when we hired Jack and Ray, and the expansion of the printmaking classes. And then in 68, 69, I think we got the new building. Now, also at this point, I think that's when Littleton was chair, and he was a very good chair. He was very aggressive, and I don't remember who was the dean of School of Education at this point.
Stiles.
It was Stiles. And Harvey would bypass Stiles. Harvey had people that he knew in Bascom Hall. And he didn't like Stiles. Stiles was a thoroughly unlikable person, as much as sort of my reactions to him. And I think he generally was not liked on campus. He had a radio program, a weekly radio program, which was terrible. It was, you know, it was an embarrassing program that he thought he was aiming at the ordinary people to explain educational policy to them. And so it had popular music, and it was just uncomfortable, and it was false. it was as if he was kind of pandering, pretending to be one of some, and yet this eliteness came through too. And I know it was embarrassing to the campus. So Harvey really was getting us a lot of attention. Harvey had taken an apartment near campus, a private apartment that he used as a club for the department. And he would have weekly luncheon groups where he would invite the chancellor in and people from various departments and a certain number of people from our department, you know. And I think it did us a lot of good. We had been a kind of a secret, and suddenly we were getting a play, you know, that he was making the university aware that they had an art department of some consequence and that it was growing. So I think our support from the university really strengthened in this period. And this was the period when we were getting into and doing the sort of final touches on the humanities building. So that was a nice period. And maybe that's the high point. Harvey took the chair twice. He was chair for 3 years, and then he dropped it for a while, and then he came back later and took it again for another 3 years. At this point, I'm beginning to run out of my material, but if you've got any questions, or that's just something that you want me to talk a little more.
Let's go back to your Oakland youth, and you talked about when you got to high school, mm-hmm. you started drawing. Mm-hmm. Had you been doing anything before that? At home, and how did you pick this up?
Yeah, I like to draw. I drew as a child. I drew cartoons, I drew comic strips, and I'd send them off to my cousins in New Orleans, for example. And as a matter of fact, I think I still have some of those that eventually all came back to me. Where did this come from? I think it came from newspaper mostly, you know, comic strips. The comics were very attractive to me. Comics were very funny in this period, you know, Cats and Jammer Kids and Jigs and Maggie, and there were some wonderful comics, Crazy Cat. Our newspaper, the Oakland Tribune, we took the Oakland Tribune, which is a very conservative paper, and so the editorial page cartoons were terribly conservative. They were very anti-Roosevelt for a long period. He was there for a long period. The cartoonist was a wonderful cartoonist, and I think he definitely influenced me. I know when I'm doing cartoons now for the Progressive, that often some of the little tricks that Jay Darling was his name, that he used. Ding Darling, yeah. He was out of Des Moines. He drew for and was syndicated. And he always did was to have to show carelessness. He would have everything littered. You know, there would always be all this junk all over the floor. And if you look at my prints, you will see often I do the same thing. Empty tire or something, tin cans, bottles scattered around. He was a very lively drawer. And although no one in my family liked his politics, I got a lot out of it. And later on, I found that he was a man of some substance, and he was an early environmentalist. He was a duck hunter, and as most of the early naturalists, of course, they were hunters, and they did their their movements really started because they wanted to save the hunting. So he was trying to save the ducks so that he would have good shooting. And he did a great deal. There near Fort Myers, there is a park, a national park or a national monument or something, the J. Darling National Monument that is given over to its place for ducks, conservation of ducks. And there's a book on Darling that when I was in Des Moines, somehow I got on this with one of the people from the museum there. And the museum has done a great deal with Darling, and they have, there's a book on him with a lot of information.
How did your father respond to this drawing?
Well, my father was a man who was difficult to communicate with. I mean, you know, he was a railroad man, okay? So, which meant that, yeah, I mean, his run was to Ogden, Utah, usually. So he would be gone about 3 days, you know, and then he'd be back for 2 or 3 days. So he was, you know, the fortunate time was when he was out of the house. And, you know, he wasn't cruel or bad or anything, but he was a heavy guy, and he had a short temper. And, you know, and he would knock you around, you know, not to break anything. But again, that's the nature of child rearing in those days, too. And occasionally there would be this very formal walk to the chicken coop with a big strap. And yeah, I think it probably worked, and I probably deserved it. But Art, I don't think he paid much attention to art, but he was very literate in music. And he played the violin and very well, and, you know, classical violin. And he had friends in, and they would play quartets, trios. My mother played the piano. So music was the art in the house, and I played the violin. I played the violin until I was 14. And while he didn't want me necessarily to be a visual artist, he would have been overjoyed if I had been a musical artist.
Siblings, talk about.
Robert.
Just have a brother? That's
just a brother, okay. Yeah. Well, Robert, he's 5 years younger than I am. And I was always his protector, and he was always my drag. And
still?
Yeah. we don't get along very well, frankly. For one thing, the war really separated us. I was away for a long time. When I came back, Robert was still in the Army. He was, I think, the 81st Division, or it was the one division that had fought in Europe.
101st.
That then
Screaming
went.
Screaming Eagles.
Well.
82nd Airborne.
No, he was in. They were motorized. They weren't tanks. Motorized combat vehicles of some kind, and they were in the Battle of the Bulge and in Europe, and then they got sent to the Philippines. So they are one of the. I think it's the only division that fought on both fronts. And so he was. When I came back, he was still in the Philippines. And they had stayed for occupation, and so I don't know. It was a long period when we were separated, and I don't know. We kind of lost it. He's a difficult person.
You mentioned the painting. You were doing a lot of painting early mm-hmm. on. What style was that? Abstract? Or
when
representational?
It was on the verge of being abstract. And I'll show you some old okay. paintings. I have a few still of that period. I started being fairly realistic, and then I went until I was completely abstract. And then I began to come back. And of course, the work I do now is just like the prints and the paintings are.
So when you went to printmaking, was that stylistic?
I started doing prints very much like the paintings. So that the early serigraphs are abstract figures. Semi-abstract figures. And that's about the way the paintings were. The paintings and the serigraphs are quite the same. The concept is the same. It was the etching. The etching began. Yeah, you could see a figurative idea in the paintings. And the etchings began in the same way. So that the initial etchings in London were abstract. But they began to change pretty rapidly as I got onto the difference in the material. And what I'd been looking for really was something more linear. And once I got into line, you know, the line began to add up to figures and to events. And that influenced the painting. So the change for me was in etching, and it pulled the painting along with it. And it just took it. It ended the serigraphs for me. I did, after getting into etching, you know, maybe a half dozen, and less and less. And it's interesting, you know, Meeker was talking about combining, and that, of course, is what I did. Initially, I was combining, and my way of combining silkscreen and etching was to print on the plate, which I found not that difficult. And so I had maybe a half dozen editions where there's an element of silkscreen combined with the etching, and the I have simply screened directly on the inked copper plate and then screened the silkscreen image on it and taken it through the press. The only problem with that, I mean, I found no difficulty in actually doing that and getting the work into paper, but the cleanup is so awful. In that you've got to, after each copy, you have to stop and clean your screens completely, or the ink will dry on the screen. So, then I found that I could get the same effect, more or less the same effect, by cutting a simple paper stencil, you see, and putting the thing on with a roller. In other words, really going to a relief technique, moving from silkscreen to relief.
One last question. You are the Leo Stepan Professor of Art.
Yeah, there's.
Chose that name.
Yes, I did. Yeah, for the chair professorship, you get to choose a name. It is a named professorship. And so Wilde, for example, who had a named professorship, he chose Alfred Sessler.
Yeah.
And I chose someone who I respected as an artist and as a human being. And Leo, I think poor Leo, was cut off, like Sessler, really before his time.
His wife was also an artist, is that right?
She was a textile artist, yes. And as far as I know, I think she lives in San Diego. I haven't had any contact
with her. Did she do anything when she was here with the department?
Or? Not with the department. No, but she was active in Madison. She showed her work, and I think she was with, there were groups of artists working in textiles, and I've forgotten her name.
Annalise.
They were good company. Very, you know, they were real human beings. With all of that implies, Leo would get into awful fights with people. He and Italo Scanga had a knockdown, drag-out political fight, and Leo got rid of Italo.
How long was he here?
He was here 2 years, and of course he came as an assistant professor. Yeah, he was right out of grad school. And he was too successful for Leo's taste. And Leo's taste was a little conservative when it came to human activity, too. And Skanga was kind of a rascal, you know.
He comes back periodically?
He's been doing prints at Tandem.
Yeah, Tandem.
Yeah. And, well, he's very, very fine artist. He was competing with Leo and winning the prizes away from Leo.
And he lost the big one.
He lost the big one.
I have just a few questions.
Sure.
And we can wrap it up. You talked about your evolution, drawing, etching, printmaking.
Yeah.
Were there any, who were the major influences on you, other artists who influenced you and your thought about the direction of your art was taking?
Well, I like the pop artists a lot. You know, initially the big influence, of course, was Picasso. When I was a student, that was the big figure. The sort of people have come and gone that I like. I like a lot of art, frankly. I think that's the way I teach. I really try to get into the sensibility of the student and to try to bring out what is natural to them. And I can work with someone who is abstract or figurative or decorative, really, because I like a lot of things. I like a product that's pretty well made. Although Rauschenberg, of the moderns, the Rauschenberg for a period, I think he has slipped somewhat. You know, people do change. Oldenburg, I liked him a lot. I liked his thinking and you know, his sort of quirky humor, his deadpan humor. And in the painting, that's a hard, it really is a hard question because there are so many painters and I don't know that I'm really looking much at anyone at the moment. I like Red Grooms, you know, there. I feel yes, Red Grooms is very close to sort of what I'm trying to do, yeah. But there aren't very many people who are working in this slot. So I find that difficult. I don't like constructivism very much. I really like it to be a little more on the painterly expressionist side. I like the Germans in general, the German painters. Otto Dix, of course, and
how about George Gross? How do you relate to him?
I like him. I like him fine. Right. he had a terrible period. You know, he came over here and he really lost it for a while, and then he kind of got with it again during the war. He's got some things that are not as well known, but they're pretty good. There was a fellow in town who studied with Gross. I'm trying to think of his name. He is a good friend of John Wilde, Marshall, somebody, who talked a lot about Gross because he really knew him well. He had been in his class in the Art Students League. He's mentioned in one of Gross's books. And so I feel I have some insight into really the personal characteristics of Gross as well as just, and there's been so much written about him. But Otto Dix is really something. I think there is a very courageous man and a terrific painter.
One final question for me. When you came into the department, couple of years right after the war, you look at, I have a roster of the art department here, you look at the people who came, it's really pretty amazing. Fred yeah. Logan, Robert Grilley, Dean Meeker, Alfred Sessler, Santos came, Donald Anderson, John Wilde, you, Harvey Middleton, all within like a 2 or 4 year period.
Yeah.
Now, was that just sort of good luck on the part of, is there anybody who can kind of take credit for bringing in this unbelievably productive group of artists, or was that just sort of serendipitous?
Well, I think probably Fred Logan can take a lot of credit for it. And the fact that he would certainly take advice from Sessler and Zingali, and then Anderson, so that you had artists playing a big part in the selection of artists. And I think for a while, and then it grew even more so than that. I think Meeker began to take a part in it, where you really had artists looking at the candidates, and they were looking at the work, and they were looking at the record, and understanding the record. So they were really doing a much better job than, say, an administrator would do, mm-hmm. who didn't have that closeness to it.
So Fred was sort of a catalyst, and
Fred was kind of the
administrator,
head.
And yeah. all that, as yeah. well as an artist himself.
Fred was an artist, yes, without much in the way of pretensions mm-hmm. of art. I mean, he accepted the fact that what he was doing was very minor and almost on a hobby level. Yeah. I mean, he was not puffed up about what he did. I think he was pretty realistic.
Wasn't it Ray Gleckler who said he was really interested in art education? He was an educator, and
he thought of himself as an art educator. That was his profession, mm-hmm. and... You know, I think he felt that he should have had a doctorate. You know, he felt that he was injured by not having a doctorate, and yet he couldn't bring himself to go back and start over again, or start it up again. So he was in this kind of in between. I think he paid a price for not having a doctorate in the university. And. But I had, I'm glad you read that list, because those are all the people that I feel made the situation, that made the department so comfortable and such a good place to operate in and to work in. And Anderson, for example, was certainly someone. You know, we had a lot of social interaction in the early days. A whole group of us lived out on the east side. We didn't live very far from it. There was a lot of partying and sort of casual dropping by and so forth. And it was a very comfortable group. I mean, it was a male group, but you know, there were the wives who were wives. In the working group, it was in the department work, it was very male at this point. I mean, you know, we liked games and football and stuff. It was fun. It was fun, you know. And, beer parties and so forth. Okay.
Thank you.